Good evening, everyone. It is Tuesday night, November 1st, 2011, the first class for the fundamentals of Judaism. For the people who are here, who might not have been here before, I do record classes and tend to put them up online. No one has to give their names. Even if you did, no one's going to be able to track you down. However, as all discussions here go, if at any point you want to say something off the record, let me know. I pause the recording and we go afterwards. So no one should feel that no one should feel that they have to censor themselves. If there's anything that you'd feel uncomfortable, even anonymous, well, I guess someone could track you down, but if there's anything that you feel not uncomfortable saying on record, just let me know. We put pause and go on ahead. So the class series is Fundamentals of Judaism, which I tried to explain as explicitly as I can how it isn't an introductory class. And it's worthwhile explaining this from the outset, too, especially for those who are listening. When you hear an introduction to Judaism class, I don't think I've actually ever been to one, and I don't think I've actually ever given one, so I'm just going to project here, and please correct me if I... Well, actually, forget me projecting. What do you think of when you hear Introduction to Judaism? Yeah, you.
Introduction to you know, basic beliefs, the holidays, things like that.
All right, so when you say an introduction to, what does that mean, an introduction to? Don't want to use the, like, an introduction to Judaism, an introduction to belief. So that uses the term introduction in the...
Right. So, I mean, an explanation of beliefs to people who are not deeply familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's pretty much, you know, what I would say. Someone is going to tell you, here are basics about Judaism. Here are laws. Here are some generalities behind things without getting to anything too specific. Okay, you'll say, oh, here are some things that Jews do, here are some things that Jews believe. Those would be things for an introduction class. And in these introduction classes, you typically have people who might be either not knowledgeable or, you know, want a refresher on one thing or another, and they're more going to be passive recipients of information. Someone knows something that you don't know. They tell you basics. You sit, you jot down, commit it to memory, or at least have some degree of familiarity. Now you know, and you go on your merry way, and or at least have some direction for, okay, here are some more things I want to study. Here are some more things I want to study. And by their nature, they're going to have to be extremely superficial because there's only so much you're ever going to be able to cover. And, you know, you can't, you know, go through all of Torah in one day. I mean, unless you just say, you know, and that you can even do on one foot. A reference, you get it, fine. If not, we move on. Yeah, I do that often. The difference with the fundamentals class, or at least as I see it, is this came out of a lot of conversations I've had in the shul. And not just in the shul, but with just various friends of mine, where people can ask questions and you give answers, and the answers don't necessarily jive because you're operating on different fundamental assumptions on how things work. Meaning, if someone says, well, you know, what am I supposed to do in this case? They say, well, here's the halacha. Someone says, well, I thought X, Y, and Z. It's like, well, where did you get all that? You know, then you have to start, you know, asking a whole lot of questions about, you know, well, where do you, you know, what is your source of information? Why is, you know, one source better than another? And the, I guess, real point of the fundamentals of Judaism class is to really evaluate, analyze, inquire critically and analytically and hopefully as logically as possible the real underpinnings of the system of how Judaism works, a combination of theory and practice, and we'll discuss about a lot of this stuff at length. All right, so as opposed to an introduction class, where you're mostly there for someone to sit and tell you, here's what Judaism believes, the issue with the fundamental class is we're going to be asking why on a whole lot of things. Right? Why is something the case? Why should we believe this? What is the basis for one belief or another? So instead of just being more of your typical, for lack of a better term, a spoon-fed type of class, of, hey, this is all the stuff you need to believe, we're going to say, well, where did all this stuff come from? and try to evaluate things as critically as possible so that the answers that we get are going to make at least a little bit more sense. This might put you at odds with a large segment of the Jewish population, because even people who are raised fully observant went to yeshiva, I don't think really have, I think they too have been more passive recipients of what someone says Judaism ought to be, as opposed to actually, you know, really tackling them. And even when people give answers, do people really know, well, does this answer make sense? Does this answer not make sense? What do you do with answers that may or may not make sense? And we'll get to a bunch of those as well. So the questions that we're going to ask more often than not are why, and try to get as much of a justification for those as possible. All right, makes sense so far. Okay. The very first distinction, get to bust out the whiteboard, very exciting.
Wow.
Yeah. The very first distinction that we really need to make here, and I'm going, and today I want to set up just a few themes more so, which is why we don't have source sheets, but you know, we will use the Chumashim just very briefly. And that is the distinction between fact and it's running too high. Haven't used life ones at all. Difference between what is fact and what is faith. And I'm using these terms mostly because I like alliteration. You know, fact would be, I would define fact, you know, for the sake of our discussions here, as something that you can prove 100% empirically. Things that absolutely no one can deny. Faith would be matters that would be maybe a little bit more subjective. Maybe things you could say almost opinions or beliefs. But since we're talking about this in a religious context, it's important to use that term faith. Did anyone here see the movie Dogma? No one? The only person here who saw Kevin Smith's Dogma is Rabbi. Fine. There's one very important dialogue that they have in the scene where he makes a distinction between an idea and a belief. And the difference being, you know, people, something that might have started out as a nice idea, someone else turned into a belief, and beliefs are things that people are actually going to kill for, you know, because it takes on such a core role, as opposed to, oh yeah, that's a nice idea, God's X, Y, or Z, but if you have a belief, then if someone challenges that belief, it can be, you know, very traumatic, and people do some really crazy things in the names of their beliefs. And it's important to keep that in mind, especially when we talk about, you know, the faith element. So let's start off with one simple exercise. Open Chumashim to page 2. All right, the very first sentence here. Right, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. Using the Ars Scroll translation here, in the beginning of God's creating the heaven and the earth. Or some say that, you know, at the beginning God created heaven and earth, however you want to define it. So at the very beginning of Bereshit, we have narrative of how the world came into being. What in this narrative would you say is fact, and what would you say is faith? Let's start off with the fact part. What can you say about here that is 100% absolute fact? You might have to think a little bit abstract and, you know, step out of yourself for a bit.
Sorry, say what the translation is again?
You could read the English translation on the... or even if not the specific translation, just even this whole narrative here about God creating the world. All right, what do you say here in this whole... it actually goes on for, you know, quite a bit. You know, what was created on each day. What would you say in these, you know, passages is actual fact?
There's lightness and there's darkness.
Is that fact? Prove that.
Turn on the light.
Okay, so you're positing the existence of light and dark.
There was light and there was dark. And
when? Can you prove that stuff happened in the way as described? In, like, yes, we can know objectively now there is something called light and there is something that we call dark. But how do you know that all that stuff happened as the way? A little bit trickier, isn't it? What you can say as a matter of fact, and I apologize, you know, if this might sound a bit too pedantic, is simply that the Bible says X. If someone quotes Tanakh, someone quotes anything in the Bible, the fact part is Bible says whatever it is someone quotes. That statement, at least, is a statement of fact, or if nothing else, it is an objective statement that could easily be put to the test. If, you know, if someone says the Bible says something, you can say, well, show me, where does the Bible say something? And then they can actually show you a chapter or verse, right? And if the person cannot do so, then, you know, the statement would be false. But a statement like that would go under the category of fact. Well, come under the category of faith is meaning. Difference is, fine, the Bible says a lot of things. What? How do you interpret those verses? What do they mean? And you can do these in, you know, two different ways. One is a matter of history. Taking the Bible at literal face value as historical events, right, would in a sense be assuming, you know, that these things happen as a matter of fact. Even, and some people, you know, are going to argue, well, actually, you know what, let's take a step back with that. Alright, so one, I suppose, interpretation of the texts of the Bible is that everything happened in the Bible happened historically, as described, right? Which means that this is, in fact, mechanically the steps of how God created the world, okay? That itself isn't by alone fact, because you can't demonstrate that, but rather would be a matter of faith. Not just in terms of faith that this happened, but also faith in the actual recording of the Bible, or some faith or some assumption that the Bible ought to be taken literally, or that the Bible ought to represent some historical events, as opposed to reading this somehow like homiletically. Right? People get that distinction? Mm-hmm. All right? Another thing would also come up to laws. Right? Even if you have like a law that's written in the Bible, right, you've got certain things that say, you know, the Bible literally says, you know, for damages, an eye for an eye. People heard that phrase, eye for an eye? Mm-hmm. So literally, right, that means you poke someone's eye out. But by matter of interpretation, right, and we'll see about this a little bit more inside, you know, how you interpret the laws, or at least the pure biblical laws, are going to be a matter of faith. Both in terms of how do you handle exegesis in the Bible, a way of interpreting text, but also the legal sources of the Bible. And the truth is, this dichotomy between fact and faith is going to come up repeatedly as we cover any textual source. Meaning, I can come up, and you know, in the past year I've made a whole bunch of source sheets coming up with a whole lot of different texts. But the fact that I quote a Gemara, right, all that can show is, or passage of the Talmud, all that proves, strictly speaking, is that the Talmud actually says what I say it says, or at least, you know, assuming I get the translations right. But it doesn't explain, well, why should you care about the Talmud? What is the, trying to get a good word here, what is the practical legal ramifications of the Talmud? I can say, well, the Rambam says this, right? If someone says, well, you have to do something because, you know, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Ramar, Mishnah Berurah, bunch of halachic works, cite X, Y, or Z as the law, there is an underlying assumption that is, these sources are somehow legally authoritative. That's a pretty big assumption when you say that one ought to follow this particular book. Good question to ask is, well, why? What is the significance of this book? Where did all of this stuff come from? And those are going to be matters, you know, of faith that are going to have to be teased out. Yeah?
Couldn't you make certain assumptions of fact in the same logic, though?
Like?
Well, you got water and grass and all these things are following the progression that they do nowadays. And I mean, from my understanding is when something happens enough times and you repeat the experiment enough times and the same thing proves to be the case, if something 1,000 years back was saying that the same progression was occurring, certain parts of the 7 days of creation, I would assume to hold, if not fact, close to fact, at least in progression, whether God did or did not do it history-wise or belief-wise or whatever, I guess would be a question, but the progression, I don't know if I would necessarily question as fact or faith.
What do you mean? I'm still not getting the progression.
Well, you have water, then you have trees, then you have you know, after the water comes the fish, because obviously fish need the water. Like, there's a natural progression.
Okay, so you're saying that the description of the Bible makes sense compared to what we know of,
right,
in terms of how progression can work.
Do you hold by repetitiveness in, I guess, now to confirm what's going on then?
I suppose.
Wouldn't that be faith?
Well, yes and no, because, I mean, don't forget, the language of the Bible, you know, presupposes the existence of God. Now, in your typical introductory class, you know, that's a non-starter of a question. God exists, right? Now, for this type of class, I'm not denying the existence of God, but I'm willing to put it under the category of faith. Why? Because people who are a whole lot smarter than I am have tried proving the existence of God, and I'm not sure it can be done for a whole slew of reasons. And the ones who say, oh, you need some empirical proof for God, assumes the existence of a God who could be proved empirically. And, yeah, I'm not necessarily going to, you know, hold up on that. And in fact, you know, thank you for bringing that up, because, you know, that is a very crucial, you know, distinction between the intro and the fundamental class. Right, I'm going to assume the existence of God. I'm going to be making a lot of assumptions here. The difference is, in your typical introduction class, people are going to take those assumptions as matters of fact, as opposed to matters of faith. And here's another distinction that I do need to make, and these are things called value judgments. Anyone know what a value judgment is?
A judgment based on...
Yes, very, very well said. Judgment based on values. To simplify this as possible, it's a matter of saying whether something is good or bad. Right? When people, you know, these, I think, trip us up often. Or things of like whether or not someone ought to do something or ought not to do something. So when you are, which could also be matters of, you know, factor of faith, but at least in, you know, this context, you know, some, when you think of like belief in God as a matter of faith, there are some who might say, well, that's bad. It's a matter of fact, and you have to believe it as absolute fact. And if you don't, that is somehow bad. Those are types of value judgments. When you have value judgments, and they're going to come up every now and again, although this really reads like valve, whatever. All of these things need to be justified. All of these things need to be addressed. Why is it bad to believe in the existence of God, even if you cannot prove it in any way, shape, or form? Or at least, well, yes, let's leave it at that. You know, is that bad just to believe in God? Now, someone at some point probably, you know, might argue that and say, like, no, you have to have 100% perfect, complete faith as if it is a matter of fact for you. You know, and that would somehow be better, but then you would have to somehow justify that position. And however you justify that position, you know, have to work your way up in terms of why is this good and what are the underlying assumptions that you make there. Any questions on this so far? No? Straightforward already? All right. Haven't been stoned yet. Okay. Another important point that has to be made, certainly from, you know, the introductory part, is this I got from my father. Yeah, here we go. The difference between a necessary read and a plausible read. We're going to be dealing frequently with texts. When we deal with texts, there are a lot of ways of interpreting texts. And some fit words better than others. Some have different styles or different forms of interpretations or different parts of interpretive traditions. A necessary read means the text can't mean anything. Well, it's not the text can't mean anything else, but a necessary read is the text minimally has to say X, Y, or Z. A plausible read could mean, well, here are a few other things that the text could add, either through embellishments and logical inferences, although, you know, there are some logical inferences that might make something necessary. But the difference is something that's necessary, things that you can't really argue about. Things that are plausible, we can have interesting discussions, and some things might be more plausible or not based on things like philology or grammar. All right? So far, so good. white people, to give a nice little form of contrast here, if you open up your Humashim 2 page XXIII, and this will provide for us a nice little contrast here of what exactly we're speaking about. So you'll notice there is a section here. We're using the Art Scroll Stone Humashim. And I'm using this not to pick on Art Scroll. I know that there are some people who like making fun of Art Scroll for a whole lot of reasons. But it's a popular religious work, and as a popular religious work, there are going to be certain expectations. I'm only using this as just one example of the introductory mode of discourse that we're going to, sort of, I guess critique is a good word. You want to read for us the paragraph here?
The Torah was accompanied by an authoritative tradition that explained the meaning of obscure passages and provided the rules and methods of accurately interpreting the text. Even a cursory reading of the Torah proves that such a tradition had to exist, that there is much more to the Torah than its written text.
Okay, so the thesis statement here, now we might be doing a bit of logic and arguments here. The thesis statement is that a cursory reading of the Torah proves such a tradition had to exist, and it is emphasized, in italics, in the text. Anyone here want to, you see the italics? I'm not making that up.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so it had to exist, meaning there is no other possibility other than to say that that it did come, the Torah came with an oral tradition. So, read next paragraph.
The Torah prescribes that one who assaults his fellow must pay an eye for an eye. Exodus 21:24.
Ayin tachat ayin. We mentioned that earlier.
Yet never in Jewish history was physical punishment meted out for an assault. The verse was always understood to require monetary compensation. Surely Moses and his successors did not take it upon themselves to change the plain meaning of God's word.
Okay, so let's look at this argument critically. Trying to prove that it had. Why? Because you have ayin, tachat, eye for an eye. According to the description here, it was never used. Moshe wouldn't make it up. This isn't legible. All right, what do you make of this argument here? Ayin tachat ayin, eye for an eye, never used as, or at least, what it says here, it was never in Jewish history physical punishment meted out for an assault, so it was always understood to require monetary compensation. Therefore, because it was never used, there must have been an oral tradition. Do you buy it? Not buy it? If so, why?
I think it's a small piece of evidence, but we need more evidence to make the point.
Well, what more evidence would help? What sort of evidence would help prove the statement that there had to have been an oral tradition passed down?
Well, I think he's going to continue in the next few paragraphs.
Well,
I'm saying it sounds like the beginning of the case, but it doesn't prove the case to me, that's all.
Okay, you're saying it only proves, because it's only one incident, so it's one point, you need at least 2 points to make a line,
right.
And this isn't enough into the data set. Even that alone, do you consider this to be a legitimate point, standalone? And please, what?
It's taking an example of something that's different from what the literal reading of the Torah it says, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily oral. It just means that it's different.
Okay. It's oral, but not different. Well,
or it's different than not.
Any difference would happen to be oral. The question would be, if it's sort of... It's the first line here, Torah was accompanied by an authoritative tradition. We could argue, well, people did stuff differently or interpreted it differently. Was that necessarily authoritative or not? All right? Now, we know from the rest of the book of, Tanakh, that people didn't really keep large chunks of the Torah for, you know, most of our history. It actually isn't all that pleasant. But to say that there had to have been an authoritative tradition because one method of interpretation, you know, sort of, or at least one verse was never actually meted out in practice.
Well, obscure passages. So I didn't say all of it.
This is not an obscure passage. There's nothing obscure about this.
I think it's weird though because isn't this whole ayin tachat ayin in the most ethical portion of? I mean, it's around mishpatim.
No, we haven't discussed that.
I mean, I'm saying it's in the part that's so descriptive about contracts and this and that and how to do everything. You would think that if it's such a legal mentality, that section you would have see exhibit A, which would be the oral Torah.
Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding of it. But I agree with him that you would want to see another point, because if we never did it before, you have the whole argument.
Okay, Stephen, take the next paragraph.
Moses instructed the Jews to perform kosher slaughter as I have commanded you, yet nowhere in the written text of the Torah do we find even one of the intricate and demanding rules of kosher slaughter. Where had he commanded them?
Yeah. So there's a commandment that, you know, we have to actually kasher tzivitcha, but that seems to be lacking. So if it seems to be lacking, where did it come from? Are you convinced by either one of these arguments? Or, I mean, these are the two that the article presents, and though it does say countless similar illustrations can be given. And the implication is all clear beyond a doubt, right? Almost protesting too much about how there is no possibility. Something you should point out, must be pointed out from both of these arguments, as stated here, is that the arguments are based, actually, on a lack of data. Right? Ayin tachat ayin, yet the fact that it hasn't existed proves something else. The fact that we don't have data, or at least in the Torah, about how Shechita is supposed to work, proves that there must have been something else along the lines with it. Does that necessarily have to follow logically of an authoritative Jewish tradition?
Did this argument get weakened when they compared the different Dead Sea Scrolls and realized that not all of them were consistent?
I don't think that they would go that far.
I'm just wondering, because if you have different books, then is there a question of, was there actually another book?
Well, it's not that it was another book. The argument here would be, when the Torah, this goes back to saying that there was an actual oral, authoritative oral tradition at Har Sinai itself, at Mount Sinai itself. Not that did other people interpret things differently, but rather there was something that came down from Har Sinai. Now, for me at least, the arguments presented here may be a little bit tenuous, or at least as described. That's just me, because they're based on again, lack of information, lack of data, and I'm sure we can, you know what, we can construe other possibilities of, you know, explaining certain phenomena. One is, well, maybe people didn't necessarily practice it. You could also come up with a few more creative ideas in terms of, you know, that could explain a certain phenomena. Important point to mention here now is, a rejection of an argument doesn't mean a rejection of an idea. What it does mean is you might have to shift it from the fact part to the faith part, and we'll describe, you know, we'll, over the couple of weeks, get into, well, what are going to be the core components of the things that make more sense to believe. So, for example, if someone gives, you know, proof for God, which we put under the faith category, people have tried proving the existence of God for centuries. If you reject a particular proof of God, that doesn't mean you deny God. You're saying that a certain proof is insufficient. That doesn't mean you're, by definition, an atheist. You're saying, well, this doesn't do it for me, or this doesn't work one way or another. Or let's say, you know, divinity of the Torah, right? Another big aspect of faith that we're going to talk, you know, in more detail about. If you, you know, someone gives you an argument about why one ought to believe the Torah is from God, or why it should be self-evident and obvious, you know, people have tried making such arguments. Not all of them are going to be convincing. Rejecting that argument doesn't necessarily mean that you reject the divinity of Torah. It means you reject an argument. Or to, you know, put it more mathematically, the opposite of A isn't B, it's not A.
Right.
All right, it's and this distinction here doesn't, you know, often gets lost in religious discussions. because otherwise it's like, if you don't believe in exactly the way that I phrase it, well, you must be an atheist, you must not believe in anything, as opposed to just saying, well, no, you're just making a bad argument. All right? And if you ever catch me making bad arguments, you know, please stop me. Or at least please ask. All right? Okay. Any questions so far? No? Wow. You guys are a lot more conciliatory. You are observing. I'm just, you know, I guess I'm, you know, from the Sunday classes, people need more of my arguers back. Makes things a lot more interesting. Well, for me at least. Yeah.
I mean, it's the basis of the topic is difficult to argue because you're talking about a lack of data. So if you don't have data, what are you arguing?
That is a wonderful point. Okay, so in terms of the structure of the class, we're going to over the next couple of weeks, we're going to spend some time talking about some of the more fundamental elements about Judaism, such as existence of God, authorship of the Torah, what is the role of the commandments in a general sense. We'll also get into some theological issues like reward and punishment and prayer. And eventually, I think we're going to get, practical in terms of having discussions on how exactly does halacha work? How does, Jewish law work? How does that develop different opinions on that? So that ultimately what I, like to do is get into actually dealing with specific areas of Jewish law, like Kashrut and Shabbat. But I don't feel that we can do that right now because I can just cite sources, but if people don't know, well, why does any of this stuff mean? Also like to add that, normally when I do this, I mean, this is more of an introduction class just to lay out certain ground rules. In the future, hopefully there'll be a lot more text-based and there'll be a lot more discussion. And I also take requests. Very big about that, especially for people who come. So if there are like any specific areas in Judaism that happen to bother you, theologically or halacha, like please bring them up. And hopefully we'll be able to get to them and tackle them, somewhat using the system that we spoke about just now. Make sense so far? All right. So I think that's going to be it just for, today, because it was important to get all this stuff out. And I guess next week we'll spend some time talking about principles of God and Torah. That is going to be a little bit more... We're going to, even though we haven't set up the ground rules in terms of why do we care about certain texts, we're going to have to start someplace. But those are going to be important questions that we will get to. So you'll have to bear with me because we can't do it all in one day. All right? So thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing people here as much as possible. Bring your friends, too. All right?
Facts or faith?
What, that I enjoy seeing you? Well, you'll have to take that on faith. All right? Have a wonderful night. Okay, sorry about that. I'm going to continue just ever so slightly over some questions that people brought up. Another thing that we're going to really be discussing in terms of what are considered authoritative sources of data. And here, it's important to make a couple of distinctions here. Like normally we're going to be quoting texts, right? Because that's a lot of what Judaism, or at least, what Judaism is based off of was what something was written someplace. But even just because you have a text, you have to consider where is this text coming from. So if it's from the Bible, we can say that it's from God. All right? Fairly reliable source. You also have, texts written by men. We can also include...
But isn't that backwards? Wouldn't it be men would be a fact and God would...
No, forget that fact-faith thing. That's, ignore that for a second here. I just need some dichotomy and I've got two halves of a board. All right? But even under, the subheading of, men, or at least, things that in the Jewish tradition, which is another loaded term here, right? We can have a whole lot of different sources that we're really going to need to spend some time discussing and evaluating. So, for example, let's say you've got rabbis, right? Rabbis are men.
What century are we talking about?
We haven't even gotten it, but that's the question is...
What's the mindset? Where are we in history?
No, but that's exactly the question. Which rabbis? right? Group of rabbis. Which ones count more than others? What time period are you talking about? Those are huge questions to ask. Then you also have the masses. At what role does convention, culturally accepted, exactly, communal acceptance come into play in the Jewish system? Because that's less a matter of what, you know, rabbis are saying, but rather what do the people kind of accept upon themselves? And kind of related with both of these is tradition, which someone used, and, you know, we're probably going to have to spend a week just trying to figure out what tradition is, right? Because for lack of a better term, well, if a bunch of rabbis and, you know, said something, or some rabbis said it, and the masses went along with it, and tradition is, for lack of a better explanation, it's a custom that's been around for a long time. We don't necessarily know how long. There's no real objective standard here, but, you know, for something that you've done for, you know, you didn't just make it up, you got it from someplace else, where does that fit in? And, you know, we're not going to be able to define all of these terms at once, but at some point we're going to sort of, you know, try to deal with all of this as we get into the matters of the halachic process, but they all have to be justified somehow. If you want to say, like, well, conventional, you know, the conventional acceptance matters, well, in what sense? In a halachic system type sense? If so, how do you prove that statement? If you're talking about from a pragmatic sense, it's a lot easier. In that, yeah, sure, this is what Jews all believe, and somehow Judaism is what Jews do, but realize that that itself has a whole lot of underlying assumptions. When you talk about rabbis, what's a rabbi? Why do we care about rabbis? You know, where did they get stuff from? Tradition. Where do you see tradition come into play? Who came up with this? Right? And at certain times, you're going to find a bit of tautological reasoning, or circular reasoning, or something is because it says so. So, like, you know, if the masses, like, if you have an idea that, say, Judaism is defined by the masses because the masses say so, that would be circular reasoning or otherwise a tautology. And is, you know, when you break it down that way, is unhelpful. It might be descriptively accurate for how many people approach Judaism and might be how things develop, but logically is, you know, lacking, because it doesn't explain, well, if the core source of authority is itself, then, you know, you're basically saying it is because it is, mostly because I say it is. And the sources of authority is going to be a huge theme that's going to underlie a lot of stuff here. So even if we don't spend a class on any one of these, they're going to be recurring themes, because we just can't do everything all at once. So we'll start, you know, next week with things like, you know, God and by that nature, also, you know, by implication in a sense, like the authority of, you know, reading verses in the Bible and reading Agadic sources. But again, we'll take those at face value for the moment. Get into that a little bit more next week. All right? So thank you. That was worth it. So have a great night. And don't forget, Sundays we're also doing the series on confronting chosenness, if you can make it. Normal time again, 9:00. And recordings are also up on the web. So have a good week.